The day on the whistleblowers. On April 16, 1985, a 31-year CIA counterintelligence officer named Aldrich Hazen Ames walked into the Soviet embassy in Washington, D.C., and he betrayed America. He offered the Soviets the identities of two KGB double agents who worked at the Soviet embassy in Washington and who had been recruited by the United States. In return, the Soviets gave Ames $50,000. That was to start. Over the next 9 years, Ames became the most damaging KGB mole in U.S. history and would receive more than $2 million from his Soviet spymasters. The result of his various betrayals was truly catastrophic, starting with the two double agents, both of whom were executed. I'm John Kiriakou, and this is The Whistleblowers. The operational secrets, plans, and protocols Ames sold to the Soviets gave them deep insight into how we reacted and thought about them. That crippled us operationally against the Soviets for years. But Kolokol, the bell, as he was known to his Soviet handlers, was especially destructive to America's human intelligence assets. Ames ultimately confessed to identifying more than 30 agents and compromised more than 100 clandestine operations. At least 10 U.S. intelligence sources were executed as a direct result of Aldrich Ames's treachery. We're going to talk about Ames in this mini-episode because he just died at the age of 84 at the federal prison in Cumberland, Maryland. At least Kim Philby, perhaps the most damaging mole in British history, was driven by a passionate belief in communism. He felt genuine contempt for British imperialism. Ames, on the other hand, well, he did it purely for, quote, greed and folly as simple as that, unquote. And those were his words. Talk about the banality of evil. And banal was a word that Ames himself used to describe what he did. Still, there was always another player in Ames's story. That was alcohol. Ames's father was an alcoholic. So was Ames, like too many CIA officers. But Ames was worse than most. His drunken escapades were notorious, but they were still tolerated, even though a supervisor once described Ames as, quote, one of the worst drunks in the outfit, unquote. Not only was Ames's father an alcoholic, he was CIA as well. He was an analyst who helped Ames get his first job at the CIA, despite the fact that Ames was a college dropout. Alcoholism stalled the CIA career of Ames's dad. In time, alcohol would leave a permanent mark on Ames's record, too. His first overseas posting was to Ankara, Turkey, in the late 1960s. Ames was tasked with recruiting foreign agents there, but his unhappy superiors back at Langley didn't think he was cut out for field work. They recalled him to Washington, sent him on a course to learn Russian, and then put him to work supporting operations against suspected Soviet spies in Washington and New York. In 1972, another CIA officer stumbled upon Ames and a female CIA employee drunkenly having sex at the office. In 1976, Ames famously left a briefcase filled with classified documents on the subway. His attitude toward work was described as lackadaisical. Yet Ames continued to fail and to fail upward. In 1981, the agency sent Ames to Mexico to recruit Soviet officials as agents. There, Ames had little success, but he did continue to engage in extramarital affairs. That included violating protocol by beginning to have sex with a Colombian cultural attaché whom he had recruited to work for the CIA. That was Maria del Rosario Casas de Puy. Despite his less than stellar performance at the CIA, Ames continued to fail upwards. On his return to the agency's headquarters in 1983, he was made counterintelligence branch chief, get this, for Soviet operations. At this point, Ames was still doing his job. He was doing it poorly, though, but at least he wasn't betraying anything other than his marriage. Ames's marriage to fellow CIA officer Nancy Segebarth collapsed for good when Ames brought his Colombian side hustle, Rosario, to America, accompanied, of course, by her mother. Ames and Rosario got married. That's when things seemed to have changed for Ames. Rosario and her mother had a taste for high living, which quickly put Ames deep in debt. Quote, I felt a great deal of financial pressure, which, in retrospect, I was clearly overreacting to, unquote. That's what Ames would later tell Senator Dennis DeConcini. In April 1985, Ames devised what he thought was a clever plan to sell the KGB some limited information for $50,000 to pay off his debts. That was the whole plan going in. But Ames realized quickly that he had crossed a line and there was no going back. And so he doubled down and tripled down on his betrayal. And that's how the worst mole in American history got started. What really is a central question to the Aldrich Ames story is how the hell did he avoid detection for two decades? Well, there were several reasons. One had to do with the CIA's culture at the time. Fear of moles had tormented various CIA directors. James Jesus Angleton, the deputy director for counterintelligence, was tortured most famously. That created a kind of counterreaction. A lot of people inside the agency were exhausted by this constant hunt for moles. On top of that, the Directorate of Operations, that's the elite within the elite, rejected as utterly unthinkable the very idea that it could harbor a mole. This kind of culture, this misplaced secrecy, covered for its brethren regardless of their errors, failures, misdemeanors, and outright crimes. On top of that, when in 1986, Ames told the KGB that he feared becoming a suspect when the mole hunt eventually began again, the KGB threw U.S. investigators off Ames's trail by constructing an elaborate diversion. A Soviet case officer told a CIA contact that the mole was stationed at Warrenton Training Center, WTC. That's a secret CIA communications facility in Warrenton, Virginia. Taking the bait, mole hunters investigated 90 employees at WTC for almost a year. They came up with 10 suspects, although the lead investigator noted that there were so many problem personalities out there that no one really stood out. It wasn't so much the agency's work that eventually outed Ames as it was Ames's own complete stupidity. But then, greed has never made anyone smarter. The FBI placed Ames under surveillance, and on February 21st, 1994, he and Rosario were both arrested at their home in Arlington, Virginia. Ames pleaded guilty 2 months later to providing highly classified information to the KGB and to its successor, the Russian Foreign Intelligence Service. In return for a lenient sentence for his wife, Ames was sentenced to life imprisonment with no possibility of parole. Rosario was sentenced to 63 months in prison, but served only 4 years before being released in 1998 and returning to Colombia, where their young son, Paul, was being cared for by his grandmother. Our guest today was in a position of real authority in Washington at the time that the case was blown wide open. Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson is a former chief of staff to Secretary of State Colin Powell, and was also Director of Policy Planning at the U.S. Department of State. I am also proud to call him a friend. Larry, thanks so much for being with us. It's good to see you.
Good to be with you, John.
Larry, first, I'd like to begin by getting your thoughts on Aldrich Ames and the damage that he did to the United States. Do you think it's fair to say that he was one of the most, if not the most, damaging spy in American history?
Well, I haven't made a study of it in particular, but my general knowledge would tell me yes. The answer to that question is yes.
Help us to quantify just what it was that Ames did. With U.S. sources in the Soviet Union and later in Russia taken out, executed in many cases, what kind of damage did that do to U.S. foreign policy?
I think what you get when you have something like that is what you got, for example, in the case I have a lot more familiarity with, and that was when Scooter Libby, Dick Cheney's chief of staff, and Dick Cheney himself outed Valerie Plame, who was a knock at the time. And the conversations I've had with Valerie with regard to what happened to the people, many of the people at least, whom she was running at the time when they found out who she really was. The first casualty, of course, are the people who die from your espionage, your failure to keep secrets. And then the second casualty, as you intimated, is your nation's diplomacy and policy. In this case, when you're involved in a twilight struggle of, as many would say at the time, life and death proportions, then you are risking your country's security in a serious and significant way. It's unconscionable in my mind that that sort of thing would happen, but I understand from having been in government for roughly 40 years that there are people like that. I think the more your society deteriorates, the more you have problems with elements in that society, like what we're having, for example, right now with the Jeffrey Epstein case, mm-hmm. the more likely you are to run into this sort of thing. And frankly, I thought I'd seen everything, but I am stunned by the length and breadth of the cognoscenti, the nomenclatura, the aristocrats, the billionaires, whatever you want to call these people, to their complicity and connivance and participation in this system, which I think root was an intelligence system too. And I think it involved the Israelis, maybe others, but certainly the Israelis. And I think Epstein was probably one of the greatest agents, assets, whatever you want to call him, for a number of people across the globe, many of whom were operating counter to U.S. interest, in my view.
You're going to get no argument from me. And indeed, this story is becoming bigger and bigger every single day. I don't want to get too far afield, but I think you've hit the nail on the head right there. Getting back to Ames, Larry, Ames wasn't the only spy who was active at the time. As it turned out, Robert Hansen, who was, of all things, the head of counterintelligence for the FBI, was also spying for the Soviet Union and later Russia. He, too, was caught and sentenced to life in prison. He died in the maximum security, actually, it's the super maximum security penitentiary at Florence, Colorado. And Harold Nicholson, another CIA officer with whom I worked, was arrested shortly after Ames was arrested. Why is it that people who are highly cleared and who have access to the country's most important secrets still are often vulnerable to recruitment by a foreign intelligence service?
I think there are different reasons. Probably in each case, you could categorize some of them. Deep debt, inability to deal with the tasks at hand as a professional, alcoholism, any number of things that might lead to it. But I think basically it's a breakdown in the very society in which the person operates. We're seeing that, I think, today. Again, I hate to take it back to Epstein, but we're seeing the fact that people just don't have the, what I would call the code of honor, the code of decency, the code of conduct is what we call it in the military, that they used to have. And people say, well, you're just an old dude. I'm 81 now. I am an old dude. Looking back on young people and envying them, and I say, well, you know, sometimes us old people have a proper view of things. And the view I have of things today is we aren't what we used to be in terms of keeping secrets, in terms of the code of conduct, and in terms of just what the Greeks called honor.
Yes.
We just don't seem to, you would be surprised how many people I chat with, how many students I had at William & Mary and the George Washington University, who sometimes would think and even express this thought that honor was an arcane thing. That it doesn't have a place in the world anymore. What has a place in the world, of course, is profit, profit, and profit.
Yes. Yes, indeed. Colonel Larry Wilkerson, stay right there. When we come back, more on the life of Aldrich Ames. Stay tuned. This is The Whistleblowers. Welcome back. Today we're discussing Aldrich Ames, who just recently passed away, and we're joined by Colonel Larry Wilkerson, former Chief of Staff to Secretary of State Colin Powell. Larry, thanks again for being with us.
Good to be with you.
Larry, a little further afield, I wanted to ask you a few questions of what's going on in the world right now. The USS Abraham Lincoln Aircraft Carrier Battle Group is not in the Gulf of in the Gulf of Oman, very near Iran. The conventional wisdom has always been that if you wanted to understand U.S. military intentions, watch the movements of these carrier battle groups. What do you think we should take from this? Do you believe that there's a real chance the U.S. might attack Iran?
Of course, there's a real chance. I don't think it's very much in the happening right now. I think what Trump is doing, and I can see many reasons why he's doing it, and some of them are negative and some of them are positive, he's bluffing. And he's bluffing in order to get what he thinks is a good deal with Iran, a deal that we could have had before and that he violated in a way that was violative of domestic law and international law when he actually conducted talks with the Iranians and used those talks as a subterfuge and then bombed, with Israel leading the way, of course. I think what he's doing now, and I just got an update on the talks a few hours ago, he's looking for a deal where he can say that he achieved it. No one else could have achieved it. What it will be, in essence, is an updated and modernized JCPOA, if you're familiar with the nuclear agreement we had before with the Obama administration that he nullified. And it won't do the things that Bibi Netanyahu wants done. But there's another factor. I think the IDF has enough people in it, enough general officers in particular, who have been rather bold with Bibi and told him what it would mean if Iran attacked Israel. It would mean the destruction of Israel, probably. I mean that seriously. It would mean the United States would not have a choice. It would have to come in, and it would have to stop the obliteration of Israel if it could. I'm not so sure it could, not with its current array of forces anyway. So there are a lot of things impacting on this, but the bottom line is I don't think we're going to have a war. I think we're going to have some successful diplomacy. Bibi's not going to like it at all, so we haven't really remedied the problem for the long term, because Bibi's last wish is to destabilize, at a minimum, the government in Iran, and at a maximum, put it in chaos. And I hate to say that, but that's what our ally in Southwest Asia is aimed at. It's what it's been aimed at for quite some time with Bibi at the helm. So this is a situation that's fraught with problems. I didn't even mention the fact that one of the reasons Putin wants to end the special military operation and get it out, get his military freed up, is because he has a defense pact with Iran. And he doesn't have a whole lot of military versatility right now because he's tied down in Ukraine. And we essentially have done this. We started Ukraine, Joe Biden, Tony Blinken, Sullivan, Jake Sullivan, they started Ukraine to bleed Russia. They had no concern for the Ukrainians who are dying. I don't think the Europeans have any concern for the Ukrainians who are dying in either. I think they have a huge case of Russophobia. They hate Russia, especially the EU leadership, who are about as democratic as a nickel. I mean, they're not, they shouldn't even be playing in this. And yet, in a vocal sense, they're playing in it every day. So we have all these things going on right now. And, oh, I didn't even mention that New START went out just a few days ago. And the last vestige of nuclear treaties died with Putin three or four times offering a gentleman's agreement with Donald Trump to extend it for a year, no questions asked. We let it lapse.
Yes, we did.
So now we're in for a nuclear arms race, and we're in for a much more dangerous world with regard to nine states that own nuclear weapons.
Boy, I wish we had another hour or even 2 hours to discuss some of these things. One of the things that I wanted to ask you about was the position of some of our other allies in the Middle East. Relations with the Gulf states are strong, but relations with Israel, of course, are stronger, and they don't always correspond. On the one hand, the Gulf states, I'm speaking specifically about Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Bahrain, Qatar, Oman, and the United Arab Emirates, might look favorably on a U.S. or even U.S.-Israeli attack on Iran. But the Israelis want to go further. And if the Israeli media is to be believed, they want to actually divide Iran up into five small and ostensibly weaker countries. Do you think that that's actually a possibility?
I don't. And right now, you have as much contention going on in the Arab world as you do, not with the impact it could have, but certainly tension as you do in the Israeli-Iranian U.S. slash-up. You have the UAE and Saudi Arabia almost at war with each other right now.
That's right.
So there's some real tension in that Arab world right now. And I don't think you have anyone, including Riyadh, that wants a war with Iran by the United States or Israel. The foreign minister of Oman, a couple of weeks ago, made the most prescient statement made in the region by a diplomat in a long time. He said, and he didn't pick any bones, he said, the real problem in the region is Israel.
Yes.
I mean, this is the foreign minister for the country most apt to offer its good offices for diplomacy and to be calm and to not want war. And they're saying that. So they have declared themselves more or less on Iran's side in this. They also know they might get hit badly. Mm-hmm. And Saudi Arabia does not need those really, really modern missiles landing in its oil infrastructure.
That's right. Can you help us make some political sense of Donald Trump's foreign policy? On the one hand, he was elected to a second term as what appeared to be an anti-war candidate. He's always yelling that he wants the Nobel Peace Prize. On the other hand, he gleefully raided Venezuela and snatched President Nicolas Maduro. He's on the brink of bombing Iran. He's threatened to invade and annex Greenland, of all places. And he has soured U.S. relations with many longstanding U.S. allies, including the Canadians and most of the European Union. So what are we supposed to conclude from all that?
You asked me an impossible question. Trump is all over the map, literally, figuratively. Figuring him out from one day to the next is like trying to take a circus clown and identify which one of the three circle rings he's going to be in on any given day. It's insane. And some of the things you just mentioned are insane in themselves, like Greenland. I'm told today the only reason he hasn't moved on Cuba, that 11 million person island off our coast, and we've embargoed for 70 years or so now, the only reason he had is his disdain for Marco Rubio, because Marco Rubio wants to do it so badly.
That's right.
What kind of administration is that?
One philosophical question for you then. What do you think Trump's actions say about the Monroe Doctrine? U.S. actions in Venezuela effectively concede the sphere of influence argument for Ukraine to the Russians and Taiwan to the Chinese? Is that what we're looking at here? That the Western Hemisphere is ours and the Chinese and the Russians can do their own thing?
We certainly laid down the template for it, didn't we?
It sure seemed that way.
I think the Monroe Doctrine died a long time ago, and it certainly died when Admiral Gorshkov, a very heavily armed frigate and a nuclear submarine, made port in Havana probably 18 or 20 months ago now. If they can do that, then the Monroe Doctrine is dead. And I suggest to you they could come back at any time. And a Chinese fishing fleet, 6,000 ships. You didn't hear me wrong. 6,000 ships in their deep water fishing fleet. They're all over the hemisphere all the time. And some of them are armed. And they are rapacious in the way they fish. In fact, the latest report from the Antarctic Committee is that they've been fishing down the krill, which is, if you know anything about krill,
yes. They're
the foundation of life on Earth. The food chain starts with them and goes up through whales and fish and so forth to protein, to what humans need. And they've reduced the population possibly below sustainability levels.
Oh, my God.
So we're looking at a real problem there. And they've already done that in the South China Sea. Most species in the South China Sea, once one of the most prolific fisheries in the world, are now where most fishery experts would say they are not sustainable any longer because they fished them down so much. It's 3/4 or so of China's protein. And you've got 1.4 billion in China. So we're doing irreparable damage to the environment and to the world. At the same time, we're doing all this crazy stuff like Trump is involved in.
Yeah, the world has become a dangerous place, all right. Larry Wilkerson, thank you so much for joining us. It's good to see you again. Thank you.
You too. Take care.
All the best. Well, that's our show for today. Please subscribe to my Substack at John Kiriakou. Stay informed, and as always, keep asking the hard questions. I'm John Kiriakou. Thanks for watching The Whistleblowers.